Stand Up with Pete Dominic. With Pete Dominic. On Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right, welcome back to the conversation. This hour will be dedicated to healthcare, health policy, health insurance, medical myths, and more, because Dr. Aaron Carroll is going to be joining us for this hour. He is a professor of pediatrics. He is the director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's the author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health. And his most recent book is Don't Crush Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. His blog is a big hit. It's at the Incidental Economist, incidentaleconomist.com. And he's just back from a really exciting trip where he went fly fishing to Alaska that I'm going to ask him about. And we're getting him on the phone right now. We had a phone problem, but he'll be joining us in just a moment. And as always, we want to help promote his Twitter feed. His Twitter handle is at Aaron E. Carroll. He's a great follow on Twitter. If you're not following him, you're really missing out on a lot of great information about healthcare, health policy, health insurance, things about the Affordable Care Act / Obamacare. At Aaron E. Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's, 7,749 followers, according to the one application that I'm using. How many will he have at the end of this hour and the replay of the program? That's anybody's guess, but give him a follow right now. And if you want to wait to see him prove himself, I understand. Good morning. Thank you for joining us. How are you? Welcome home.
I'm good. How are you?
You were in Alaska. Fly fishing, and you posted the pictures at the Incidental Economist, and you've apologized to Alaska. Why?
Well, I'd be honest with you. It's like I've been in almost, my brother and I took a summer, we drove around the country. I think I've been in pretty much almost every state but Alaska, and it was never on my list of things to do. I don't think I ever would have gotten there, and it just, this trip somewhat fell in my lap where it just, there was a cancellation on another group's trip, and they asked if I wanted to go, and I sort of just went on a whim, and it was spectacular. It's almost hard to describe in words. The state is just amazing, and it was just the best time. And if I've ever maligned Alaska or made fun of it or the practices of its people, I apologize. It was one of the best experiences in my life.
One of the great things about you having the opportunity to take this trip is that you're in a fantastic marriage. Tell just quickly about your wife, Amy. Let's give her some respect and some attention. This, like you said, this trip fell upon your lap. Well, that's hard. You have three kids.
Yes.
Your wife it takes care of your kids, and now you're going to just all of a sudden up and leave, and your wife says to you, basically, you can't miss this opportunity.
A friend called and said, can you go? And my initial instinct was to be like, there's no way. It was only 2 weeks away, and I knew I'd have to arrange some things, and my kids were going to visit my in-laws in Milwaukee, and my wife would be home alone, and then I was supposed to drive up to Chicago and then Milwaukee with her to pick up the kids, and I just was like, there's no way I can pull this off in 2 weeks. And when my wife got home, she walked in the door, and I said, you know, they called me, and she's like, you're going. There was just no question.
We could call my wife right now and see. But a lot of wives, a lot of husbands would not do that, would not say that's a great opportunity, you're going. And I don't know that mine, I think I'd have to break her down a bit, I think.
Well, I'm not going to comment on anyone else's wife, but mine were.
Comment on my wife, please.
Spectacular. No.
Comment on my wife. Why won't you comment on my wife? Are you afraid of my wife?
I'm not getting in this argument. No.
Are you scared of my wife?
I do not wish to upset your wife. That's the pussy of
a lot of people, because a lot of people, you know my wife, all right. A lot of people are afraid of my wife. That's why I
don't think I would say I'm afraid, but I have no wish to get into an argument. Part of the problem is because it'll be conducted by proxy, and I have no wish to get into that.
Oh, you're too smart. Yeah. Do you lose arguments with your wife at home? Because you don't lose them. You do.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because there are some things that cannot be argued with logic, and I have to learn to let those things go.
Is that hard?
Very. Jesus, are you kidding me? Very hard.
What kind of phone are we using today? Is this your
landline? We had to use a cell phone. Every time you called my regular phone, it was just so staticky. I don't know what's going on. It's Indiana. You know, what are you going to do?
Call his regular phone. Let him answer, and he can switch over to that, and we'll decide. Can we do that?
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that'll be a fun thing to try to do
to test the
different quality.
We'll do actual study.
Yeah, this will be. Well, this is a conclusive study. Do you think? Do we need a blind phone?
Well, I mean, it's not a randomized controlled trial or anything, but it is a study.
All right. I want to talk with you about, like, it's weird that when you're away, the entire, like, all of us that are following healthcare, health policies, specifically, I guess it's probably most accurate to say the developments of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as it's about to be implemented. When something happens, when something's said, we go to the Institute of Economists to see what Aaron Carroll says, but he's fly fishing in Alaska,
yeah.
So we get nothing.
Totally off.
So we've been waiting for you to get back, and we're happy you're back, but... For me, the thing that I really want to get you to respond to, I don't think you've blogged about it, at least up until last night. I haven't gone to the Instant All Comments today, but was Howard Dean's op-ed yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. Have you had an opportunity to look at that and what he said?
He basically came out against the Independent Payment Advisory Board, if I remember correctly.
Right.
And so I think it's somewhat ridiculous, I got to be honest, because... I mean, this is a guy that fought and said that the bill shouldn't be passed without a public option. I mean, he was truly fighting for the fact that we were going to have a bill that was much more liberal, had much more government intervention, had much more government control. And now he's all of a sudden saying that the Independent Payment Advisory Board is a horrifically bad thing. And he's very vague about it. He has no, specifics about what it would be. And it's one of those things where, this is not a controversial thing in the past.
Now the phone's really kicking out. So put that cell, put your iPhone on mute and grab that landline and see what happens.
Okay, let's try that. Hold on.
All right, let's try this study and see.
The problem was I had like both going at the same time.
Yeah, maybe that was it.
Is this better?
No.
No, that's the landline, and it sounds worse than your mic the other day, Pete.
Wow.
Oh, the landline is horrific. I don't know what's going on.
Wow, it's like even cutting out. Wow, this sucks.
Cordless phone.
So it's is that a cordless landline?
Not really. No, it's a landline. I don't know what's going on.
Not really.
It got better. Yeah, Alfred is pushing back on not really. It either is or is not a cordless phone.
And there's a cord. It's just dangling here. Not. Really.
It's not plugged in. Aaron. Now he's gone altogether.
No, I'm gone. I'm back in the cell phone.
Oh, all right.
Cell phone. You hear me?
Yeah, let's just stay here, I guess.
Okay.
Anyway, the independent, the IPAB that Howard Dean has criticized, basically, that's part of the Affordable Care Act was to create this board that can do what? And this is what is referred to as death panels, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. If Medicare health expenditures rise more than, I think it's like a half or 1% above GDP in any year, then the IPAB has the ability to say, we got to stop this. We have to find some way to save money in Medicare. And they make recommendations to Congress, and Congress needs to muster a 2/3 majority or some large majority Congress just needs to overrule them, which will be difficult given the fact that Congress can't get its act together to do much of anything these days. And if they do overrule them, they have to come up with their own plan to reduce Medicare spending so that we keep it to a half to 1 point above GDP. It's the idea that we just can't have Medicare spending rise so dramatically. There's two important points to this. First is that Medicare expenses have been rising rather slowly recently, and so it's very unlikely that the IPAB would even kick in the next year or two, given how things are looking, because their expenses are rising slower than half to 1 point above GDP, so it's not even a big concern. The second thing is that the law specifically says that IPAB can't, quote-unquote, ration. They can't, like, deny people care. They can't make anything that sounds like rationing. It specifically says it in the law. So there's a lot of people that believe the only thing the IPAB could really do is try to reduce physician reimbursement, because that's sort of the only tool left in the armament when they get through with everything else. If they're not going to deny people care, they're not going to say you can't have this. They can just pay less for it. So, of course, the AMA and physicians cannot stand the IPAB. And so the idea, because they don't want
the
to
AMA
pay,
is the organization that advocates for doctors, the American Medical Association.
It's one of the best lobbying groups in the country. And when I say best, I mean most powerful and most successful. I'm not making a moral judgment about them. But there are groups, lots of businesses that hate the IPAB because it could theoretically make them less money. And part of the problem is that Howard Dean now works for a lobbying firm. And it's very possible, if not likely, that a lobbying firm is representing groups perhaps the AMA, which hate this. And now all of a sudden he's done a complete 180 and, you know, trotted out to the Wall Street Journal to write op-ed. It's a problem because
I got to say, let me just say, you know, I've always liked Howard Dean. I've had him on the program a couple of times. I really liked him in 2004. And I am really, really disappointed because Dr. Carroll is not going to make it as clear as I can, and I make a moral judgment. I am going to, and it really, he is now become a lobbyist, and he's kind of saying something that he didn't really used to say or believe, and it's disheartening because it's the same old song and dance for Howard Dean as it is for so many other politicians. I call him a sellout now, and I'm gonna try to get him on the air and take him to task for this because I think it's really disappointing. I've always been a big fan of his, but anyway, back to the nuts and bolts of this. I don't know. Did I interrupt you?
No, I think it's fine. I mean, this is just, first of all, I take everything politicians say with a grain of salt because politicians will,
you know, but he's not a politician. That's the thing. He's not currently serving, and that's why it's that much worse.
But I'm saying when he was a politician and he said things out loud, I took those with a grain of salt as well. Howard Dean at one point thought that single payer was the only solution. Howard Dean at one point thought that, you know, the law should not pass without a public option. Howard Dean at one point thought that the law was fantastic without a public option. Now Howard Dean thinks that the Independent Payment Advisory Board is horrifically evil. That's why when I want to turn to what do I think about the Affordable Care Act and what do I think about, you know, its implications for policy? To be honest with you, politicians, and that's what he was at the beginning, are not where I turn first, nor are lobbyists for that matter. And it's a good lesson for all of us. But those are the types of people that get printed at the Wall Street Journal at their whim, unfortunately. That's the way it works.
All right, we're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's. Follow him on Twitter. A couple things before we get to your latest post about part-time workers, the Affordable Care Act, which is very interesting. One of which is not so much, you know, a health policy question, but it's certainly been largely discussed as we see the posturing and leveraging between Republicans and Democrats in Washington, D.C. Today, CNN Money reports that a government shutdown won't shut Obamacare. Obamacare would keep running even if the government were to shut down, according to a new congressional report. The new health care law draws funding from sources that are not subject to congressional budget process, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. I just want you to comment on, clearly, the House Republicans especially have tried to do everything they can. They've repealed Obamacare 39 times, whatever. Now they're trying to defund Obamacare. And one, I guess, strategy would be to shut down the government to shut down Obamacare. But I don't know how read in you are to this strategy, but what do you make of that?
I think here's the thing. It depends what your strategy is. If your strategy is to rally your base, it's probably fantastic. If your strategy is to actually make Obamacare not work, that's very unlikely to happen. In the same way that they can't stop Medicare when they shut down the government. Because there are parts of the government that don't require Congress to actually pass a law every day to keep going. I mean, there are parts that would shut down when the government shut down, but not everything would shut down. The military isn't going to shut down, for instance. It's not like the wars stop if Congress refuses to work. And so as a tactic to literally make Obamacare stop working, it will fail. As a tactic to try to force the president's hand, well, I think it's incredibly unlikely to work, but I suppose they could have an argument that it could, that President Obama could fear, and the Democrats could fear, a government shutdown so bad that the Senate, which you still have to remember is majority Democrat, would pass a law repealing Obamacare, and then President Obama would sign it. That's not going to happen.
Right.
And I don't think that threatening to shut down the government is going to force his hand. He just won an election, as did all those Democrats in the Senate. So it's not as if they don't feel that they have, you know, public support behind them. This is a very vocal minority in Congress and the Senate that's actually pushing for this. I think it's a group of 12 Republican senators at the moment. They represent, obviously, some of the most conservative senators. They feel so strongly about Obamacare that they think he's going to shut down. But part of this could be that it's a good way to grandstand. I mean, it's a good way for them to score points with their base, to look real conservative, knowing that there's no chance this is actually going to happen. Because with only 12 of them, if everybody else votes to keep the government going, it's going to keep going. And so I think probably what you're seeing is some Republican senators who know they're going to have to vote to keep the government going, who are upset that they have other Republican counterparts who are hitting them from the right and making them look less conservative than they would like to look, which is not good for them.
What about the strategy of defunding Obamacare? That's a strategy that the Wall Street Journal has a headline: Tea Party pushes to defund Obama's health care law. If you wanted to defund this law, could you?
Well, again, what do they mean by defund? It's like, you know, they have to pass a new law, you know, taking away spending that has already been put. Okay, there's two types of spending, I guess, in the government. It's important to talk about this. There's what we call entitlement spending or automatic spending, things that Congress doesn't have to approve every year. That's already been put in place, like Medicare. They don't have to re-up Medicare every year. But they do have to pass, for instance, a new military budget every year. They have to pass all kinds of spending every year. And so some things have to be voted on, or they have to have a budget, or they have to get together to do it, or there's no money. And so those things they can, quote unquote, defund by refusing to pass the allocation of money that they have to do every year. But other things they can't. They've already been passed in other laws. They've been put in place, their entitlement spending, their automatic spending, and those things they can't stop. And Tom Coburn said yesterday from a CRS report that much, if not the vast majority, of the spending in Obamacare is in the automatic camp. They can't stop it. You know, they can't say, we're not going to give you the money. They can tinker with some minor things like the exchanges, and they tried to defund some of the IRS stuff and some of the things they might have some control over. But the majority of spending, the Medicaid, the subsidies, a lot of that is just automatic, and they can't stop it, and they can't defund it just by refusing and holding their breath.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. And my next question has to do with the headline from Reuters. Obamacare mandate delay will cost $12 billion, affect 1 million workers. President Barack Obama's decision to delay implementation of part of his health care reform law will cost $12 billion and leave a million fewer Americans with employer-sponsored health insurance in 2014, according to congressional researchers. Why has President Obama done this? He's been accused of throwing the Constitution out the door, that this is illegal, that it's he can't do this. He doesn't have the power to do this. So he's getting hit from that angle. And now we find out that it's actually going to cost $12 billion and a million people that work at these companies are not going to get insurance. Why is he doing it?
Well, I think there's two reasons that people would say he's doing it. The first is that I think the Republicans, you know, you have to remember, Republicans have been working very hard to try to make it as difficult to implement the law as possible. They have been defunding the things they can defund. And some of the things that they've been defunding is the money that was hoped to be used to create the infrastructure to do all the work necessary to run the subsidies, to run the exchanges, to run all the parts of government that you would need in order to make this work. And President Obama's claiming, and I of course can't tell if he's being completely honest or not in this, that they are not able to get the infrastructure done in time to do the measurements and the questionnaires and the things that they would need to do to make the employer penalty work. How do they check to see if all the jobs are offering job insurance? How do they check to see if the premiums are, you know, costing 9.5% or more of people's incomes? How do they check to see that every plan is exactly qualified as it needs to be? They say they can't get it done in time for 2014, so they're pushing it back to 2014. In this case, as I argued with, I think it was Michael Cannon, a few weeks ago, they succeeded. They the Republican strategy of trying to, you know, sabotage the law worked. And they can't get it done in time, so they pushed it off a year. The other argument is that businesses have lobbied very hard to have the employer penalty removed, and this is a concession to them to try to make rollout as positive as possible. That they pushed it off a year, and maybe they'll push it off another year, and maybe they'll just get rid of it entirely, but it's a concession to businesses to try to make them more on board with the Affordable Care Act. But this is the problem is that everybody keeps conflating the individual mandate and the employer penalty. And those are two completely separate things. The independent mandate is an essential part of the three-legged stool that makes the whole law work.
The individual mandate. You said the independent mandate.
I'm sorry, individual mandate. If you remove the individual mandate, then we have no kind of way to get healthy, or no inducement for healthy people to buy insurance. It could fracture or the risk pool. It could lead to adverse selection. It could cause a death spiral in insurance premiums.
Those are all things a lot of people might not understand. But why do you need? I mean, why do you need healthy people to buy insurance?
So let's do that. Let's back up to there again. The whole point of the Affordable Care Act was the idea that everybody should be able to buy insurance. Even if they're sick, they can never be denied a plan. And even if you're sick, your insurance can't cost more than if you were healthy. That's great. Everybody loves that. The problem is that built into that is a completely rational reason for healthy people never to buy insurance. Because you can wait till you get sick, you can buy a plan, you can't be denied, and you can buy it at the same price as if you were healthy. So why buy insurance at all if you're healthy? Just wait till you get sick. But if only sick people buy insurance, then insurance is going to cost a fortune. Even more people won't buy it. It'll cost even more. And that's what I mean by death spiral, is that premiums all of a sudden start shooting up so high that no one can afford insurance and the private insurance market dies. So we need a way to induce healthy people to buy insurance so that everyone is in the risk pool and that it's the most stable and that it works the best. And you could do that through a single-payer mechanism like Medicare, where everybody just gets the insurance. Or you can come up with a mandate or a number of other different mechanisms. But the easiest one to do was a mandate which basically said, hey, either buy it or you pay a small penalty. And that penalty is compensation, basically saying, like, you're basically buying the right to buy insurance later. So it's insurance for insurance. That's why we have the individual mandate.
What is adverse selection?
Adverse selection is if only sick people buy insurance. In other words, if you have two groups of people and one is healthy and one is sick, it will cost far less to insure the healthy group than it will to insure the sick group. Because, of course, you know, really in the end, what they do is they add up how much did it cost the healthcare, they divide it by the number of people, and they set a number and say, this is what we need to charge people to buy the insurance. If your group's entirely healthy, you charge them very little. If the group's very sick, you charge them a ton. It's why an elderly person costs more than a young person. It's why, you know, a 23-year-old healthy male costs next to nothing, but a very sick 73-year-old female costs a ton of money. So adverse selection is if your risk pool gets too sick, then your insurance becomes so expensive that all the people who can will jump to the other insurance that's cheaper, and next thing you know, your insurance, no one can afford it all. It's adverse selection. It means it's not sort of fair. And so to avoid that, we have an individual mandate. The individual mandate is essential, or something like it, is essential to making the entire Affordable Care Act work. And it's how, by the way, Massachusetts works. It's how Switzerland works. It's how Germany. All of them have a law that says you got to have insurance because you need healthy people in the risk pool if you're going to have those kinds of regulations. The employer penalty is a completely different animal. The employer penalty was in there solely to save the country $12 billion. That's it. It made it $12 billion cheaper. I'm using the number because they just made an announcement of how much it's going to cost without it. It said, hey, if we can get employers to pay for $12 billion of insurance, then the government doesn't have to pay subsidies.
Right. So that's where that $12 billion comes from. It comes from the fact that employers will be picking up the tab and not taxpayers.
Right. And so if you didn't have to pay for the subsidy, in other words, when those people go to the exchanges, they're going to get subsidies paid for with tax dollars from you and me. And so we'd rather that companies pay for the insurance, like most companies do, in which case we're not taxing everybody. It's just coming out of individual wages. People are sort of paying for their own insurance. It saves, let's use their number, let's save $12 billion a year. So without the individual mandate, law falls apart, potentially. Without the employer penalty, the bill costs $12 billion more next year. I'm not trying to minimize $12 billion, but they're not the same thing. One is, is it worth angering businesses and taking all the negative effects of the employer penalty to save $12 billion? We could have that debate. Is it worth stripping out the individual mandate and potentially fracturing the risk pool and putting private insurance in danger totally? Well, that's a whole different argument. But people keep saying, well, if we take the employer penalty out, maybe we should take the individual mandate out. They're not the same. They don't serve the same purpose. They don't have the same magnitude. They don't have the same effect. They have nothing to do with each other.
Let me ask you about a debate that we were having in my office, the conversation we were having. I was having it with all three of my producers, Melanie, Alfred, and Chris. And it was happening on CNN, coincidentally, my old intern now work is an intern at CNN, and they brought her on to basically ask the question, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but it was basically talking about young, healthy people. And if you don't get insurance, you'll have to pay a fine, about $95 or something. If you do, it's going to cost you $141 a month. And my folks were telling me, you know, these guys were telling me that, you know, that is really, really expensive, $141 a month. My dad, who was just on the air a little while ago, who sold insurance, drilled it in my head. I could never go a day without health insurance because, God forbid, something happened or I got sick. He'd have to pick up the tab, A, and he didn't want to have to do that. And so he would rather pick up the insurance for me. So I was lucky because my dad saved me. Right. But not obviously most people don't have that option. But when it comes to that choice that young, healthy people make, the question apparently is going to be, will it work? Will the incentives work? Will this fine incentivize people to buy health insurance at a cheaper rate that the Affordable Care Act creates through these exchanges, but still maybe not cheap enough?
Well, let's back up. I want to hit that $141 again. Who has the $141?
That's how much it's going to cost on the exchanges, apparently. I think that's in the figure they were using.
Right, but was that before or after subsidies? Because I'm going to bet that was before anybody calculated a subsidy.
I don't know.
You have to remember that anyone who makes
anyone
who makes less than 400% of the poverty line was going to get money from the government to pay for that. If you make less than, you know, 133% of the poverty line, you're going to get Medicaid. You're going to get free health insurance. So, you know, it's not $141 for everyone. It's $141 for somebody who makes 400% of the poverty line. Remember, the poverty line for a single individual is something like, I don't know, $14,000 or $15,000. So at that point, you're talking about an individual making $60,000. We're not talking about technically poor people paying $141. A 25-year-old making $60,000 is doing fine. I mean, compared to the rest of the country, that's way above the median income. That's pretty good. I wasn't making that much money when I was in my young 20s. I was still in school. Again, it's like we throw these numbers out and they can sound scary, but they have to be in context. Who's paying $141? The person who's paying $141 is making 60 grand a year almost. So it's not everybody pays $141. You have to sort of take the individual. So what I usually do is say, give me your salary. Let's go to the calculator. Let's see exactly what it's going to cost.
Right.
And you can see what it's, and that's different.
Right. I found the transcript from CNN. Here's Carol Costello on CNN. We're concentrated on young people. From what I understand, young people are being urged to buy health insurance through state health care exchanges set up in individual states. And there are three levels to the insurance. Cheapest level is $141 per month for young people. That's
right.
What they would pay for health insurance in general, right?
No, well, okay, that is what someone would pay without any subsidies whatsoever. So that may be correct. That may be bronze. So bronze without any subsidies could be $141 a month. But the only person who actually pays the full $141 a month is somebody making 400% of the poverty line. And again, so I would say like, okay, so are you saying that somebody makes $60,000 a year and it's $141 a month, that is too much? That's not even close to 9.5% of their income. So there are workers who pay. You have a job. You probably get insurance for your job. I bet you're paying way more than that percentage of your income for insurance. That guy's getting a steal.
It's still going to cost young people, as she says in her response to what you just said, because she had someone on from the Obama administration,
mm-hmm,
that gave a similar answer that you just gave. She said it's going to cost young people a certain amount of money every month for health insurance. The penalty if they don't do that in 2014 is $95 per year or 1% of your income, which is,
right,
of course, less than what they would pay for insurance. How do you convince young people who are healthy to buy insurance under this plan?
So some people may, well, here, two reasons. One, you're right, in the first year it's only $95, but it rapidly goes up to where it's $695. And at that point, you have to decide whether you'd rather pay $700 for nothing or the $1,000 that it will cost for you to get actual insurance. And so most people would buy, kick in the extra $400 and actually get insurance. Again, though, who are we talking about?
Right.
What are the numbers of young people who make 400%.
All right, so guys, what do you think here? Any questions? Is there confusion here? Let's take this to real life. Are you following this? Is this confusing? Do you know?
It's not.
Are you listening to the program?
It's not $141 for somebody who makes $25,000 or $30,000 a year. It'll be significantly less than that because they're going to get subsidies if their job didn't provide insurance, and probably their job will provide insurance. So you have to have, first of all, a job which doesn't provide insurance, because, of course, if you're unemployed and making zero, you're going to get Medicaid. So you have to have a job that doesn't provide insurance, where they're paying an employer penalty already, and you make $25,000 or $30,000, you're going to get a subsidy. So it's not $141. It could be half that. Or some number, and in which case, then you're saying, would I rather pay $500 a year for insurance or pay a $700 penalty to have nothing? Of course you'd rather pay $500 to have the insurance, so they will buy the insurance.
You guys, questions?
I mean, I don't know. So if I'm out of college and I'm getting paid nothing, I haven't found a job yet, I can get insurance through Medicaid?
You get Medicaid. Yeah, you make zero. You'd get Medicaid. Well, of course, if you live in a state with the Medicaid expansion. So it's that's a whole different ballgame. But yeah, if you make less than the poverty line or less than 133% of the poverty line, you'll get Medicaid. Everybody.
That's if you're off your parents' insurance.
Well, first of all, if your parents want to buy you better insurance, feel free. Okay, but we're talking about...
Well, if you're off your parents, I mean, Melanie's
this
saying...
This is for somebody out of college who doesn't have a job, who's...
We're talking about people who don't have insurance. I mean,
who doesn't have insurance yet.
But the other thing that the Affordable Care Act does is that you can stay on your parents' insurance up until age
26. But let's say your parents can't afford it. Okay, I'm just saying, let's say your parents don't want to pay for your insurance. If you make less than the poverty line or you make zero, you get Medicaid. If you make 133% of the poverty line, your insurance will. If you make 150% of the poverty line, your insurance will cost almost next to nothing because the subsidies will be so large, it will be almost free.
All right.
And you'll get private insurance.
Hey, pretty good.
What's the poverty line now? What's the
for a single person? I think it's just under $15,000.
So 133% above
different
that
in New York.
Is it different?
No. It's a poverty line. It's a national poverty line. It's a federal poverty line. It's not done state by state.
All right. Well, if there's not any other questions or comments, I'm going to take a break and come back and talk about another.
Honestly, look, I'll run the numbers with them. If they want to, send me your salary, we'll run the numbers.
These guys all have insurance.
We have insurance.
Yeah. So they're concerned. We were talking about.
I think the real, I don't call you out, Pete, but the real discussion in the office was that you didn't believe that young people didn't have insurance. You were like, "This is insane." Are you? What do you mean, knowing people don't have insurance? And we were like, "Yeah, real."
I didn't have insurance.
Freelancers. Think of a person who's a freelancer. They probably don't have insurance.
No, I mean,
you can buy into freelancers.
It wasn't that I didn't think that people didn't. I was saying,
"Well, you're like, why would
insane? Why wouldn't you?"
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, I was a freelancer for a long time until I got this job here full time in 2008. I never had employer. Sponsored insurance. Never in my life till I was 32 years old. I was freelancing as a stand-up comedian, and that's always been my rant. I was making pretty good money, but I had to pay. We had to pay a lot in premiums, and we were healthy. No medications, no nothing, and we still had to pay really high premiums, and that seemed really screwed up. So even though I was earning a lot, I had to pay a lot, even though I was healthy. And that's changed because of the Affordable Care Act.
Why is there such it seems like a push of like disinformation or misinformation? No, doesn't it seem like it though?
Yeah.
Why does a CNN segment exist in which they're
because media wants controversy. The media wants people to get upset or angry. They're not pushing an agenda on one side or the other. They want people to be afraid, and they want people to tune in.
Well, they want people to watch, and fear will induce one to watch any segment, any show.
Yeah. But this is why some people have taken to calling this sort of apocryphal group who's going to be screwed the bros. Because basically, to pay that $141, you have to find this almost mythical young male who makes $60,000 a year and is like then claiming that this is too much. Like, who's complaining? Like, who's making 60 grand a year and bitching about insurance that'll cost him $1,000? $1,000 a year? I would go crazy if my.
Does anybody want to disagree with that? $60,000 a year and you're paying $1,000 for insurance? Does anybody think that's unfair or that you're not still living pretty well as a single person?
Yeah. I aspire to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, we would love to be that guy.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like, who's boo-hoo-hoo? This is the thing. It's like, everybody should cry over this apocryphal, mythical person that most young people would love to be.
Right. All right. When we come back from a break, we'll get your phone calls, and we need you to make them. So give us a phone call right now and join the conversation. It is 866-994-6343. 866-99-INDY. Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us. He's at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter and writes blogs at The Incidental Economist. And he is answering the question this morning. He's already posted this blog. Is Obamacare leading to more part-time workers? We'll get his answer on that, and he'll answer your questions when we come back from a brief advertisement.
Because Glenn Beck wanted too much money. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
I hate that liner.
Rarely comes out of the garage.
Nah.
I think every time I play it, you say you hate it.
Nah.
But one time, Melanie played it, and you didn't say anything.
That's because I'm far easier on her than I am on you. I mean, what do you want?
Well, that's the only reason I played it again.
Well, get rid of it. It's stupid. Alfred probably thought of it.
Because Glenn Beck wanted more money.
Tell Alfred talk.
Well, now we could change it to Limbaugh.
Rush. What are we talking about?
Hannity.
How much of a jerk you are.
I played the Glenn Beck liner.
We never played that.
Because
yeah.
Glenn Get rid of
it.
Beck.
Just dumb. I mean, it's just not good. That's what.
Yeah. I was surprised that they actually made it into the system.
He works here now anyway.
Dr. Aaron Aaron Carroll is joining us right now on a shitty cell phone. But we're really, really happy to have him. He
cursed,
is
man. Listen what? To you. You just cursed.
Oh, I forgot. Sorry. Oops.
Now we're off the air, aren't we?
No. A crappy cell phone. Dr. Aaron E. Carroll. And we lit up the phones, Aaron. I wanted to answer your question about is Obamacare leading to more part-time workers? Just going to say, if we don't get to it, it's on the blog. Very thorough. But let's get to these phone calls. And let's start. And everybody hold on here. We'll get to everybody. Daniel in Missouri, you're on the air with Aaron Carroll. Go ahead, Daniel.
Go ahead.
Daniel?
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go.
Okay. You were talking just before the break about this mythical young male makes a decent amount of money.
I didn't say mythical. I meant apocryphal. Just rare. Not they exist.
Apocryphal means rare, I've learned.
Well, apocryphal means it's just very unlikely to be there.
Okay.
Fair enough. Well, I'm pretty lucky to be one of those mid-20s guys who's making a little more than 60 grand a year. And I'm certainly not complaining about anything, but I was also kind of wondering about that. Does that Affordable Care Act issue even come into play at all when the employer is still providing for insurance?
Well, no, that's the thing. Is the other part of this is that it makes it even more apocryphal. The vast majority of people who have jobs that earn 60 grand a year are working in great jobs that provide insurance. So you've already got it. So none of this applies to you anyway.
Can you stop using that word? I mean, can you just, with us at least?
I love apocryphal. Sorry.
Well, I know you do, but a lot of us don't.
Okay, so you have to, again, not only have to find a guy making six, you have to find a guy who's got a job, who's 26, and makes 6 grand a year, and their job doesn't provide insurance already. Because if your job already provides insurance, none of this applies to you.
Daniel, are you satisfied with that?
Very, yeah, and certainly makes that the person who would complain about that even more rare or apocryphal. Yeah.
Exactly.
You prefer apocryphal over rare as a choice of words?
I do enjoy big words. I'm not going to lie.
All right. Well,
it's not just rare. It's sort of a combination of rare. Mm-hmm.
Lisa, Michigan, you're on Stand Up.
Hey, Pete. Just wanted to make a comment to people. I work for probably one of the largest corporations in the world, and there really isn't much difference between the rates for singles and families, and I think we pay close to $150, probably a single person where I work. So $141 is very reasonable. But the funny thing is what people don't realize is that there really is a real crisis with healthcare in this country. And the company that I work for, we do cost analysis, and we calculate our labor costs on whether we want to build a plant in the U.S. or expand overseas in India and China. We include medical, the benefit costs, and the labor, and we're competing with other countries where their labor costs don't include the medical because it's paid for by the government. And so when people don't have insurance, as we all know, they go to the ER, it raises the rates for corporate America that provide insurance for their people.
To continue
as is just the biggest myth out there. It's just killing us. So I really think Obamacare is the first step to really address the issue. I think the GOP needs to get on board, help tweak it, make it better, but just stop all the nonsense that it's so awful.
Thank you, Lisa. Is there anything you'd add to Lisa's comments, or is there anything you disagree with, Dr. Carroll?
No, I think, but it's one of the longest running arguments for a single payer system. I mean, there's longstanding, quotes or jokes coming out of Detroit, for instance, that every time a car rolled off the line, that the first $1,000, $2,000 of it was just to pay for the health care for the workers, and that it was killing the American auto industry because they could not compete with prices with the Japanese or any other country because they had to add thousands of dollars just for this benefit.
And I think I don't know if this is a fact. I wasn't inside, but. But part of the reason why I think it was the GM or something moved from Detroit, like 5 miles across the lake to Canada, is because of Canada's single payer.
Sure, that came into play as part of it. This is true, but it's no. We won't. We only talk about how Obamacare is going to kill business. We never talk about how healthcare in general is killing business.
Right.
But it's if you look at graphs, and I have a great slide that I always use in my talk, it shows that inflation and workers' wages have been unbelievably flat for the last 15 years. But health insurance at private companies, plus the premiums have gone skyrocketing. And so the reason that wages have probably been so stagnant and held down is because all of the extra money they might make has to keep being pumped into their health insurance. It's killing the businesses who have to pay for the rest of insurance. It's killing the workers who have to keep paying higher and higher premiums. And it's consuming a larger and larger share of GDP. It's sucking up a ton of money. And that's money that would go to us.
Wesley, Newark, New Jersey. You're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll. At Aaron E. Carroll on the Twitter. And while Wesley's talking, I'll see if we've made any progress today on new followers. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I would just like to ask the question. It sounds like the health insurance exchange is a better setup than employee sponsor because you actually get to choose your own insurance. Whereas though with employee insurance, like I didn't choose my employee insurance, he chose it for me. So isn't, like I would think people would be ecstatic to have more freedom in choosing a better insurer than what they say, for instance, between Blue Cross or Aetna. Am I right or am I wrong?
I think there's a completely valid argument to be made what you're saying there. In fact, there was a lot of talk of just letting all jobs go to the exchanges. Unions fight this. Lots of people fight this because they've already negotiated for spectacular insurance and they don't want to sort of take a step back to what most people would consider just phenomenal insurance. There would have been the biggest bipartisan push for healthcare reform probably of the last decade before this was the Wyden-Bennett Act, which basically would have ended employer-based health insurance and put everybody on exchanges to do exactly what you're talking about. And that's, how many other countries do it that use a private insurance system to reform their market and to achieve universal coverage. So I think what you're saying is exactly true. There's a lot of evidence that bears this out. It's a lot of how many other countries do it. It's how many, probably tons of wonks and, tons of policy people would love for this to happen. That makes a lot of sense. Why not just have one big national exchange? Why not provide tax credits to everyone on a sliding scale to buy insurance and eliminate the tax deduction right now that exists and is somewhat unfair? And just make it one big national exchange where private insurance companies could compete in the way they are on a much smaller scale in the exchanges right now. And then everybody would have the same options, the same choice, and be able to sort of buy the same insurance.
We're talking to Dr. Carroll, and he is I have not done a good job plugging today as well as I'd like, begging, if you will, for new followers. And we've made very little progress, only a few. We've had the hours where there's been hundreds, or over 100, or almost 100. Hopefully the replay listeners will follow up. But you got to think about, from a data point of view, from an evidence point of view, you're on here almost every week for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
A program like mine doesn't attract the type of listener that might use Twitter. Of those who do use Twitter, I would imagine that hear you, so many of them have given you a follow.
Why do you think your program does not attract listeners?
Because the type of material that I talk about attracts a little bit older audience. period. For example, if you do a show here at SiriusXM on, say, the Cosmo Channel or even ONA or Howard even, or if you do a TV show, MTV, if you're on MTV for a minute, I mean, your Twitter following blows up because
When you say older, what do you mean?
I mean 30 and up, man.
And they don't use Twitter?
Not nearly as much as 15 to 30. That's some totally guessing. No evidence for that.
All right. I mean, I just think you're underestimating the number of people, sort of even in the age 30 demographic, who use Twitter.
Well,
but I do agree that probably when you're talking about kids, but still. Come on, I think you're underselling your audience.
Maybe. I mean, we get new listeners obviously every minute, and some listeners drop, and then we get more listeners, and potentially obviously our subscriptions at SiriusXM is doing really well. But.
Okay, I just thought by older you meant like 70, and I'm like, well, I don't think your audience is 70.
No. Okay. I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you think let's say 40 and up? Uses Twitter?
I thought you were going to go with the argument that your show is now on at a time when people perhaps are driving and therefore are not listening. And
I think the show is always
Twitter followers.
I would say most people listening to radio, period, are commuting some way or another. But so I don't know that there's ever a time slot where people are listening overwhelmingly aren't in their car or automobile. But the other thing, I just think that people 30 and over, 40 and over, certainly, and everything up, don't use Twitter nearly as much for the simple excuse that most of them say, well, I don't have anything to say. Why would anybody care what I have to say? Or not realizing that the main purpose is not saying something, but following what other people you do want to hear say have to say.
I mean, of
your friends that are around the age of 40,
yes,
give or take 5-10 years, I mean, are most of them on Twitter?
They have Twitter accounts that they have. I would not say that they actively use them to the level that I do.
All right. Well, at
on the other hand, they go Facebook crazy, and I'm not a big Facebook fan.
That's a totally different thing, though.
Yeah.
At Aaron E. Carroll is his Twitter handle, and you really should follow him if you're not already. All right, let's get to that. I think you answered a bunch of questions because there's a full bank of calls, and when you answered that first caller's questions, two of them dropped, and I think we did a pretty good job of that. So great. We still have time. Well, we don't really have too much time for another call, but maybe one if you want to give us a call. Is Obamacare leading to more part-time workers? Where does this come from?
Well, I think the employer penalty has an inducement in it, which we should all acknowledge, to try to get people to shunt into part-time jobs as opposed to full-time jobs, because if they work less than 30 hours a week, they don't count towards a full-time employee for the penalty. And the penalty only applies to workers who work more than 30 hours a week. So lots of people have complained that we're going to see all the jobs, go from full-time to part-time. And this is one of those where, again, you have to put it in context. Well, whose job is going to part-time? How many jobs are going to part-time? Because I don't doubt that a job will go to part-time. I don't doubt that some jobs will go to part-time because there will be some businesses. But is this a widespread thing that's going to happen hugely, or is it something that's concentrated to a small segment? I saw a post that I highlighted from another blog where they actually looked at data from BLS, which I think is like the labor department, where they looked at the average work week. And overall, the average work week has been quite stable over the last year. It's not been dropping radically. And in fact, when you look at various industries and the majority of them, I think it was 10 of 13, it has not dropped. Now, it is dropping in retail, where some people will say this will have the largest effect. So, in other words, it is happening in one segment of the market. But it's important to always remember that laws come with trade-offs. All policy comes with trade-offs. Not everyone will benefit. As I said to you, the 26-year-old who made $60,000, who had a job that didn't provide insurance and didn't want to buy insurance, he's getting, quote-unquote, screwed by the law. So, somebody's going to be upset. In this case, it is true that in some sectors, they are perhaps, and we can't even prove that it's blamed on Obamacare, but they are perhaps shunting more workers into part-time jobs. But overall, this is not a terribly widespread effect, and the average work week has been quite stable over the last year.
Let's quickly go to, do we have time for Derek? Derek in Chicago.
How are you doing?
Go ahead, Derek, quickly.
I just want to ask, how is this not taking away our freedom if you're going to penalize me for something I don't want to do?
Well, okay, but you can make the same argument about tons of things the government does. You might not want to pay taxes, but you do. You might not want to, not put your kids into jobs, but you can't do that. There's lots of things you might want to do. You might want to do drugs. You're not allowed to do them. This is one of those cases where often...
This provides you freedom.
Well,
I think.
Okay, but conservatives will argue that when the private sector or the private market can't control or can't fix a problem, that is when the government should step in.
Well,
and for decades, the private sector has been unable to fix this problem, and at that point, the government steps in.
Derek?
So,
he hung up.
Okay, well, even then, it's just like you have to remember that we're forcing you to buy something you say you don't want now, but at some point, you will want it. All of you will. And at that point, you'll demand it, and it'll cost us way more.
And that's why it's very interesting to this last but there's a post on the Incidental Economist. There's a lot I didn't even get to on your blog. A lot of good stuff there that we didn't get to, and we had Aaron for an hour about Montana. What's this piece about Montana? Because this is fascinating.
Yeah, Montana actually, like the governor, without Congress. Remember, this is Montana. We're not talking about a blue liberal state here. They decided to set up a completely government-run clinic for their 11,000 state employees. So the government, the employees of the clinic could just go for free to this clinic. And because the government ran it, of course, it was far cheaper. They put the doctors on salary. They negotiated for, reductions in what they would pay because they were using bulk buying. And so with everything you would, theoretically hate about government-run healthcare in Montana, of all places. And many of the House legislators fought it, screamed about it, but there's a fascinating article that it saved Montana about $1.5 million last year in what they would have had to pay for healthcare alone. They even have quotes from like the Republican legislators who've now retired and used the clinic and actually love it, and that it's getting just rave reviews all over the place. They're expanding to a second clinic now, and they're expanding this is government-run healthcare in Montana. And I think it's just one of those great examples where everybody seems to hate all these things until they love them. They hate Medicare until they love Medicare, and now they got to defend Medicare. You hate these kinds of clinics until you love them and you experience them and you realize it's just not as bad as everybody said. And I just wonder if that's the way, 10 years from now or more, we'll be talking about Obamacare. Everyone hates it right now, but maybe once it starts working.
And you guys put up a great post a little while back documenting all those complaints about Medicare and Social Security back in the day juxtaposing them today. Kevin Richmond, quickly for Dr. Carroll. We got to wrap it up.
Hey, guys. Hey, Dr. Carroll, I've heard you several times on Pete's show, and I've never heard you talk on national television like MSNBC or CNN. I don't know if you do that, but I would just have a suggestion if you could try to get yourself a lot more people can hear it.
He'd be happy to. Obviously, if he's joining me for an hour every week, he'd be more than happy to go on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and anywhere else. Huffington Post just had him a couple weeks ago. Not long enough.
Pete, if you could stop,
honest to God, I've tried. I do everything I can.
Well, if we could do something too, let me know because you have so much knowledge about it.
Yeah.
I can explain.
I'd like to revisit that next week. Why they might not have Dr. Carroll on. I'd like to explain that. We've talked about it a lot. All right, Aaron. Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome. Happy birthday to my dad, who I know is still listening. Pop, Melanie, Alfred, Christopher, my producers. Chris, have a great vacation. He's going away for a few days. We'll miss him. To Drew and Phil, our interns, great job. Think for yourself and be the change you want to see. We'll talk to you right here on Stand Up tomorrow.